again, and this time connected with the Reverend's forehead, dead center. Big Jim felt the shock travel all the way up to his shoulder. Yet Lester staggered forward, wagging his Bible. It seemed to be trying to talk. Big Jim dropped the ball to his side. His shoulder was throbbing. Now blood was pouring onto the carpet. And still the son of a buck wouldn't go down. Still he came forward, trying to talk, and spitting scarlet in a fine spray. Coggins bumped into the front of the desk. Blood splattered across the previously unmarked blotter, and then began to sidle along it. Big Jim tried to raise the ball again, and couldn't. I knew all that high school shot-putting would catch up with me someday, he thought. He switched the ball to his left hand and swung it sideways and upward. It connected with Lester's jaw, knocking his lower face out of true and spraying more blood into the not-quite-steady light of the overhead fixture. A few drops struck the milky glass.
Gah!
Lester cried. He was still trying to sidle around the desk. Big Jim retreated into the knee hole. Dad? Junior was standing in the doorway, eyes wide, mouth open.
Gah!
Lester said, and began to flounder around toward the new voice. He held out the Bible.
God! Don't just stand there, help me!
Big Jim roared at his son. Lester began to stagger toward Junior, flapping the Bible extravagantly up and down. His sweater was sodden, his pants had turned a muddy maroon, his face was gone, buried in blood. Junior hurried to meet him. When Lester started to collapse, Junior grabbed him and held him up.
I got you, Reverend Coggins, I got you, don't worry.
Then Junior clamped his hands around Lester's blood-sticky throat and began to squeeze. 14. 5 interminable minutes later. Big Jim sat in his office chair, sprawled in his office chair, with his tie put on special for the meeting, pulled down and his shirt unbuttoned. He was massaging his hefty left breast. Beneath it, his heart was still galloping and throwing off arrhythmias, but showed no signs of actually going into cardiac arrest. Junior left. Rennie thought at first he was going to get Randolph, which would have been a mistake, but he was too breathless to call the boy back. Then he came back on his own, carrying the tarp from the back of the camper. He watched Junior shake it out on the floor, oddly businesslike, as if he'd done this 1,000 times before. It's all those R-rated movies they watch now, Big Jim thought, rubbing the flabby flesh that had once been so firm and so hard.
I'll help,
he wheezed, knowing he could not.
You'll sit right there and get your breath.
His son on his knees gave him a dark and unreadable look. There might have been love in it. Big Jim certainly hoped there was, but there were other things, too.
Gotcha now. Was gotcha now part of that look?
Junior rolled Lester onto the tarp. The tarp crackled. Junior studied the body, rolled it a little farther, then flipped the end of the tarp over it. The tarp was green. Big Jim had bought it at Burpee's, bought it on sale. He remembered Toby Manning saying, "You're getting a heck of a good deal on that one, Mr. Rennie."
"Bible,"
Big Jim said. He was still wheezing, but he felt a little better. Heartbeat slowing, thank God. Who knew the climb would get so steep after 50? He thought, I have to start working out. Get back in shape. God only gives you one body.
Right, yeah, good call,
Junior murmured. He grabbed the bloody Bible, wedged it between Coggins' thighs, and began rolling up the body.
He broke in, son. He was crazy.
Sure.
Junior did not seem interested in that. What he seemed interested in was rolling the body up, just so.
It was him or me. You'll have to...
Another little taradiddle in his chest. Jim gasped, coughed, pounded his breast. His heart settled again.
You'll have to take him out to Holy Redeemer. When he's found, there's a guy, maybe...
It was the chef he was thinking of, but maybe arranging for Chef to carry the can for this was a bad idea. Chef Bushy knew stuff. Of course, he'd probably resist arrest. In which case, he might not be taken alive.
I've got a better place, Junior said. He sounded serene. And if you're talking about hanging it on someone, I've got a better idea.
Who? Dale fucking Barbara. You know I don't approve of that language.
Looking at him over the tarp, eyes glittering, Junior said it again.
Dale fucking Barbara. Hell. I don't know yet, but you better wash off that damn gold ball if you mean to keep it. And get rid of the blotter.
Big Jim got to his feet. He was feeling better now.
You're a good boy to help your old dad this way, Junior.
If you say so, Junior replied. There was now a big green burrito on the rug, with feet sticking out the end. Junior tucked the tarp over them, but it wouldn't stay. I'll need some duct tape. If you're not going to take him to the church, then where... Never mind, Junior said. It's safe. The Rev will keep until we figure out how to put Barbara in the frame. Got to see what happens tomorrow before we do anything. Junior looked at him with an expression of distant contempt Big Jim had never seen before. It came to him that his son now had a great deal of power over him. But surely his own son. We'll have to bury your rug. Thank God it's not the wall-to-wall carpet you used to have in here. And the upside is it caught most of the mess. Then he lifted the big burrito and bore it down the hall. A few minutes later, Rennie heard the camper start up. Big Jim considered the golden baseball. I should get rid of that, too, he thought. I knew he wouldn't. It was practically a family heirloom. And besides, what harm if it was clean? When Junior returned an hour later, the golden baseball was once again gleaming in its lucite cradle. Missile strike imminent. 1.
Attention, this is the Chester's Mill police. The area is being evacuated. If you hear me, come to the sound of my voice. The area is being evacuated.
Thurston Marshall and Carolyn Sturgis sat up in bed, listening to this weird blare and looking at each other with wide eyes. They were teachers at Emerson College in Boston. Thurston, a full professor of English and guest editor for the current issue of Plowshares. Carolyn, a graduate assistant in the same department. They had been lovers for the last 6 months, and the bloom was far from off the rose. They were in Thurston's little cabin on Chester Pond, which lay between Little Bitch Road and Presteel Stream. They had come here for a long fall foliage weekend, but most of the foliage they had admired since Friday afternoon had been of the pubic variety. There was no TV in the cabin. Thurston Marshall abominated TV. There was a radio, but they hadn't turned it on. It was 8:30 in the morning on Monday, October 23rd. Neither of them had any idea anything was wrong until that blaring voice startled them awake.
Attention, this is the Chester's Mill police. The area...
Closer. Moving in.
Thurston. The dope. Where did you leave the dope?
Don't worry, he said, but the quaver in his voice suggested he was incapable of taking his own advice.
He was a tall, reedy man with a lot of graying hair that he usually tied back in a ponytail. Now it lay loose, almost to his shoulders. He was 60. Carolyn was 23.
All these little camps are deserted at this time of year. They'll just drive past and back to the little bitch.
She pounded him on the shoulder, a first.
The car is in the driveway. They'll see the car.
An oh shit look dawned on his face.
Evacuated. If you hear me, come to the sound of my voice. Attention. Attention.
Very close now. Thurston could hear other amplified voices as well. People using loudhailers. Cops using loudhailers. But this one was almost on top of them.
The area is being evac...
There was a moment of silence. Then,
hello, cabin. Come out here. Move it.
Oh, this was a nightmare.
Where did you leave the dope?
She pounded him again. The dope was in the other room, in a baggie that was now half empty, sitting beside a platter of last night's cheese and crackers. If someone came in, it would be the first goddamn thing they saw.
This is the police. We are not screwing around here. The area is being evacuated. If you're in there, come out before we have to drag you out.
Pigs, he thought. Small-town pigs with small-town piggy minds. Thurston sprang from the bed and ran across the room, hair flying, skinny buttocks flexing. His grandfather had built the cabin after World War II, and it had only two rooms. A big bedroom facing the pond, and the living room kitchen. Power was provided by an old Henske generator, which Thurston had turned off before they had retired. Its ragged blat was not exactly romantic. The embers of last night's fire, not really necessary, but très romantic, still winked sleepily in the fireplace. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I put the dope back in my attaché. Unfortunately, no. The dope was there, right next to the remains of the brie they had gorged on before commencing last night's fuckathon. He ran to it, and there was a knock on the door. No, a hammering on the door.
"Just a minute," Thurston cried, madly merry.
Carolyn was standing in the bedroom doorway, wrapped in a sheet, but he hardly noticed her. Thurston's mind, still suffering residual paranoia from the previous evening's indulgences, tumbled with unconnected thoughts. Revoked tenure, 1984 thought police, revoked tenure, the disgusted reaction of his three children by two previous wives, and, of course, revoked tenure.
"Just a minute, just a sec, let me get dressed."
But the door burst open, and in direct violation of about 9 different constitutional guarantees, 2 young men strode in. One held a bullhorn. Both were dressed in jeans and blue shirts. The jeans were almost comforting, but the shirts bore shoulder patches and badges.
"We don't need no stinking badges," Thurston thought numbly.
Carolyn shrieked, "Get out of here!"
"Check it out, Junes," Frankie DeLessop said. "It's when Horny met Slutty."
Thurston snatched up the baggie, held it behind his back, and dropped it into the sink. Junior was eyeing the equipment this move revealed.
"That's about the longest and skinniest dorkola I've ever seen," he said.
He looked tired, and he came by the look honestly. He'd had only 2 hours sleep, but he was feeling fine, absolutely ripping, old bean. Not a trace of a headache. This work suited him.
"Get out!" Carolyn shouted.
Frankie said, "You want to shut your mouth, sweetheart, and put on some clothes. Everyone on this side of town's being evacuated."
"This is our place. Get the fuck out!"
Frankie had been smiling. Now he stopped. He strode past the skinny naked man standing by the sink. Quailing by the sink might have been more accurate. And grabbed Carolyn by the shoulders. He gave her a brisk shake.
"Don't give me lips, sweetheart. I'm trying to keep you from getting your ass fried. You and your boyfriend... Get your hands off me! You'll go to jail for this! My father's a lawyer!"
She tried to slap him. Frankie, not a morning person, never had been, seized her hand and bent it back. Not really hard, but Carolyn screamed. The sheet dropped to the floor.
"Whoa! That's a serious rack," Junior confided to the gaping Thurston Marshall. "Can you keep up with that, old fella?"
"Get your clothes on, both of you," Frankie said. "I don't know how dumb you are, but pretty dumb would be my guess since you're still here. Don't you know..." He stopped, looked from the woman's face to the man's, both equally terrified, equally mystified.
"Junior," he said.
"What?"
"Titsy McGee and Wrinkle Boy don't know what's going on."
"Don't you dare call me any of your sexist..."
Junior held up his hands.
"Ma'am, get dressed. You have to get out of here. The U.S. Air Force is going to fire a cruise missile at this part of town in..." He looked at his watch. "A little less than 5 hours.
"Are you insane?" Carolyn screamed.
Junior heaved a sigh and then pushed ahead. He guessed he understood the whole cop thing a little better now. It was a great job, but people could be so stupid.
If it bounces off, you'd just hear a big bang. Might cause you to shit your pants, if you were wearing any. But it wouldn't hurt you. If it punches through, though, you'd most likely get charbroiled, since it's going to be really big, and you're less than 2 miles from what they say is going to be the point of impact.
"Bounces off what, you dimwit?" Thurston demanded.
With the dope in the sink, he now used one hand to cover his privates. Or at least he tried to. His love machine was indeed extremely long and skinny. The dome, Frankie said, and I don't appreciate your mouth.
He took a long step forward and punched the current guest editor of Plowshares in the gut. Thurston made a hoarse woofing sound, doubled over, staggered, almost kept his feet, went to his knees, and vomited up about a teacup's worth of thin white gruel that still smelled of brie. Carolyn held her swelling wrist.
You'll go to jail for this,
she promised Junior in a low, trembling voice.
Bush and Cheney are long gone. This isn't the United States of North Korea anymore.
I know that, Junior said,
with admirable patience for one who was thinking he wouldn't mind doing a little more choking. There was a small, dark Gila monster in his brain that thought a little more choking would be just the way to start the day off right. But no, no. He had to do his part in completing the evacuation. He had taken the oath of duty, or whatever the fuck it was.
I do know it, he repeated, but what you two massholes don't get is that you aren't in the United States of America anymore either. You're in the Kingdom of Chester now, and if you don't behave, you're going to end up in the dungeons of Chester. I promise. No phone call. No lawyer. No due process. We're trying to save your lives here. Are you too fucked dumb to understand that?
She was staring at him, stunned. Thurston tried to get up, couldn't manage it, and crawled toward her. Frankie helped him along, with a boot to the butt. Thurston cried out in shock and pain.
That's for holding us up, Grandpa, Frankie said. I admire your taste in chicks, but we got a lot to do.
Junior looked at the young woman. Great mouth. Angelina lips. He bet she could, as the saying went, suck the chrome off a trailer hitch.
If he can't get dressed by himself, you help him. We've got four more cabins to check out, and when we get back here, you want to be in that Volvo of yours and on your way into town.
I don't understand any of this, Carolyn wailed.
Not surprised, Frankie said, and plucked the baggie of dope out of the sink. Didn't you know this stuff makes you stupid?
She began to cry.
Don't worry, Frankie said. I'm confiscating it, and in a couple of days, booyah, you'll smarten up all on your own.
You didn't read us our rights, she wept.
Junior looked astonished. Then he laughed.
You have the right to get the fuck out of here and shut the fuck up, okay? In this situation, those are the only rights you have. Do you understand that?
Frankie was examining the confiscated dope.
Junior, he said, there's hardly any seeds in this. This is fucking primo.
Thurston had reached Carolyn. He got to his feet, farting quite loudly as he did so. Junior and Frankie looked at each other. They tried to hold it in. They were officers of the law, after all, and couldn't. They burst out laughing simultaneously.
Trombone Charlie is back in town, Frankie yelled, and they gave each other a high five.
Thurston and Carolyn stood in the bedroom doorway, covering their mutual nakedness in an embrace, staring at the cackling intruders. In the background, like voices in a bad dream, loud hailers continued to announce that the area was being evacuated. Most of the amplified voices were now retreating toward Little Bitch.
I want that car gone when we get back, Junior said, or I will fuck you up.
They left. Carolyn dressed herself, then helped Thurston. His stomach hurt too much for him to bend over and put on his own shoes. By the time they were finished, both of them were crying. In the car, on their way back down the camp lane that led to Little Bitch Road, Carolyn tried to reach her father in her cell. She got nothing but silence. At the intersection of Little Bitch and Route 119, a town police car was pulled across the road. A stocky female cop with red hair pointed at the soft shoulder, then waved at them to use it. Carolyn pulled over instead and got out. She held up her puffy wrist.
We were assaulted by two guys calling themselves cops, one named Junior and one named Frankie. They...
Get your ass gone or I'll assault you myself, Georgia Ruse said. I ain't shittin', honey pie.
Carolyn stared at her, stunned. The whole world had turned sideways and slipped into a Twilight Zone episode while she was asleep. That had to be it. No other explanation made even marginal sense. They'd hear the Rod Serling voiceover any time now. She got back into the Volvo. The sticker on the bumper faded but still readable. Obama 12. Yes, we still can. And detoured around the police car. Another, older cop was sitting inside it, going over a checklist on a clipboard. She thought of appealing to him, then thought better of it. Try the radio,
she said. Let's find out if something really is going on.
Thurston turned it on and got nothing but Elvis Presley and the Jordanaires trudging through How Great Thou Art. Carolyn snapped it off, thought of saying the nightmare is officially complete, and didn't. All she wanted was to get out of Weirdsville as soon as possible. 2. On the map, the Chester Pond Camp Road was a thin hook-like thread, almost not there. After leaving the Marshall cabin, Junior and Frankie sat for a moment in Frankie's car, studying this. "Can't be anybody else down there," Frankie said. "Not at this time of the year. What do you think? Say fuck it and go back to town?" He cocked a thumb at the cabin. "They'll be along, and if they're not, who really gives a shit?" Junior considered it for a moment, then shook his head. They had taken the oath of duty. Besides, he wasn't anxious to get back and face his father's pestering about what he'd done with the Reverend's body. Coggins was now keeping his girlfriend's company in the McCain pantry, but there was no need for his dad to know that. At least not until the big man figured out how to nail Barbara with it. And Junior believed his father would figure it out. If there was one thing Big Jim Rennie was good at, it was nailing people. "Now it doesn't even matter if he finds out I left school," Junior thought, "because I know worse about him. Way worse." Not that dropping out seemed very important now. It was chump change compared to what was going on in the mill. But he'd have to be careful just the same. Junior wouldn't put it past his father to nail him if the situation seemed to call for it. "Junior, Earth to Junior." "I'm here," he said, a little irritated. "Back to town?" "Let's check out the other cabins. It's only a quarter of a mile, and if we go back to town, Randolph will find something else for us to do." "Wouldn't mind a little chow, though." "Where, at Sweetbriar? Want some rat poison in your scrambled eggs, courtesy of Dale Barbera?" "He wouldn't dare." "You positive?" "Okay, okay." Frankie started the car and backed down the little stub of driveway. The brightly colored leaves hung moveless on the trees, and the air felt sultry, more like July than October. "But the mass holes better be gone when we come back, or I just might have to introduce Titsy McGee to my helmeted avenger." "I'll be happy to hold her down," Junior said. "Yippee-ki-yi-yay, motherfucker." 3. The first three cabins were clearly empty. They didn't even bother getting out of the car. By now, the camp road was down to a pair of wheel ruts with a grassy hump between them. Trees overhung it on both sides, some of the lower branches almost close enough to scrape the roof. "I think the last one's just around this curve," Frankie said. "The road ends at this shitpot little boat land."
"Look out!"
Junior shouted. They came out of the blind curve, and two kids, a boy and a girl, were standing in the road. They made no effort to get out of the way. Their faces were shocked and blank. If Frankie hadn't been afraid of tearing the Toyota's exhaust system out on the camp road center hump, if he'd been making any kind of speed at all, he would have hit them. Instead, he stood on the brake, and the car stopped 2 feet short. "Oh, my God, that was close," he said. "I think I'm having a heart attack." "If my father didn't, you won't," Junior said. "Huh? Never mind." Junior got out. The kids were still standing there. The girl was taller and older, maybe 9. The boy looked about 5. Their faces were pale and dirty. She was holding his hand. She looked up at Junior, but the boy looked straight ahead, as if examining something of interest in the Toyota driver's side headlamp. Junior saw the terror on her face and dropped to 1 knee in front of her. "Honey, are you okay?" It was the boy who answered. He spoke while still examining the headlamp.
"I want my mother, and I want my breakfast."
Frankie joined him. "Are they real?" Speaking in a voice that said, "I'm joking, but not really." He reached out and touched the girl's arm. She jumped a little and looked at him.
"Mama didn't come back."
She spoke in a low voice.
"What's your name, hon?" Junior asked. "And who's your mommy?"
"I'm Alice Rachel Appleton," she said. "This is Aiden Patrick Appleton. Our mother is Vera Appleton. Our father is Edward Appleton, but he and Mommy got a divorce last year, and now he lives in Plano, Texas." We live in Weston, Massachusetts, at 16 Oak Way. Our telephone number is...
She recited it with the toneless accuracy of a directory assistance recording. Junior thought, oh, boy, more mass holes. But it made sense. Who else would burn expensive gasoline just to watch the fucking leaves fall off the fucking trees? Frankie was also kneeling now. Alice, he said, listen to me, sweetheart. Where is your mother now?
Don't know.
Tears, big, clear globes, began to roll down her cheeks.
We came to see the leaves. Also, we were going to go in the kayak. We like the kayak, don't we, Aid?
I'm hungry,
Aiden said mournfully. And then he too began to cry. Seeing them like that made Junior feel like crying himself. He reminded himself he was a cop. Cops didn't cry, at least not on duty. He asked the girl again where her mother was, but it was the little boy who answered.
She went to get whoops.
He means whoopie pies, Alice said. But she went to get other stuff, too, because Mr. Killian didn't caretake the cabin like he was supposed to. Mommy said I could take care of Aiden because I'm a big girl now, and she'd be right back. She was only going to Yoder's. She just said don't let Aid go near the pond.
Junior was starting to get the picture. Apparently, the woman had expected to find the cabin stocked with food, a few staples at least. But if she'd known Roger Killian well, she would have known better than to depend on him. The man was a Class A dumbbell, and had passed his less-than-sterling intellect onto his entire brood. Yoder's was a nasty little store just across the Tarker's Mills town line, specializing in beer, coffee brandy, and canned spaghetti. Ordinarily, it would have been a 20-minute run there and another 20 back. Only she hadn't come back. And Junior knew why. "Does she go Saturday morning?" he asked. "She did, didn't she?"
"I want her," Aiden cried, "and I want my breakfast. My belly hurts."
"Yes," the girl said. "Saturday morning, we were watching cartoons, only now we can't watch anything because the electricity's broke."
Junior and Frankie looked at each other. Two nights alone in the dark. The girl maybe 9, the boy about 5. Junior didn't like to think about that. "Did you have anything to eat?" Frankie asked Alice Appleton. "Sweetheart, anything at all?"
"There was an onion in the vegetable drawer," she whispered. "We each had half, with sugar."
"Oh, fuck," Frankie said. Then, "I didn't say that. You didn't hear me say that. Just a second." He went back to the car, opened the passenger door, and began to rummage in the glove compartment. "Where were you going, Alice?" Junior asked.
"To town, to look for Mommy and to find something to eat. We were going to walk past the next camp and then cut through the woods."
She pointed vaguely north.
"I thought that would be quicker."
Junior smiled, but he was cold inside. She wasn't pointing toward Chester's Mill. She was pointing in the direction of TR-90, at nothing but miles of tangled second growth and boggy sumps. Plus the dome, of course. Out there, Alice and Aiden would almost certainly have died of starvation. Hansel and Gretel minus the happy ending. And we came so close to turning around, Jesus. Frankie had returned. He had a Milky Way. It looked old and squashed, but it was still in the wrapper. The way the children fixed their eyes on it made Junior think of the kids you saw in the news sometimes. That look on American faces was unreal, horrible. "It was all I could find," Frankie said, stripping off the wrapper. "We'll get you something better in town." He broke the Milky Way in two and gave a piece to each child. The candy was gone in 5 seconds. When he had finished his piece, the boy stuck his fingers knuckle-deep into his mouth. His cheeks hollowed rhythmically in and out as he sucked them. Like a dog licking grease off a stick, Junior thought. He turned to Frankie. "Never mind waiting until we get back to town. We're going to stop at the cabin where the old man and the chick were, and whatever they got, these kids are going to get it." Frankie nodded and picked up the boy. Junior picked up the little girl. He could smell her sweat, her fear. He stroked her hair as if he could stroke that oily reek away. "You're all right, honey," he said. "You and your brother both, you're all right. You're safe."
"Do you promise?"
"Yes." Her arms tightened around his neck. It was one of the best things Junior had ever felt in his life.
4.
The western side of Chester's Mill was the least populated part of town, and by 9:15 that morning, it was almost entirely clear. The only police car left on Little Bitch was Unit 2. Jackie Weddington was driving, and Linda Everett was riding shotgun. Chief Perkins, a small-town cop of the old school, would never have sent two women out together, but of course, Chief Perkins was no longer in charge, and the women themselves enjoyed the novelty. Men, especially male cops, with their endless yee-haw banter, could be tiring.
"Ready to go back?" Jackie asked. "Sweetbriar will be closed, but we might be able to beg a cup of coffee."
Linda didn't reply. She was thinking about where the dome cut across Little Bitch. Going out there had been unsettling. And not just because the sentries were still standing with their backs turned and hadn't budged when she gave them a good morning through the car's roof speaker. It was unsettling because there was now a great big red X spray-painted on the dome, hanging in midair like a sci-fi hologram. That was the projected point of impact. It seemed impossible that a missile fired from 200 or 300 miles away could hit such a small spot, but Rusty had assured her that it could.
"Lynn," she came back to the here and now.
"Sure, I'm ready if you are."
The radio crackled.
Unit 2, do you read? Over."
Linda unracked the mic.
"Base, this is 2. We hear you, Stacy, but reception out here isn't very good. Over."
"Everybody says the same,"
Stacy Moggan replied.
"It's worse near the dome. Better as you get closer to town. But you're still on Little Bitch, right? Over."
"Yes," Linda said. "Just check the Killians and the Bouchers. Both gone. If that missile busts through, Roger Killian's going to have a lot of roast chickens. Over."
"We'll have a picnic. Pete wants to talk to you. Chief Randolph, I mean. Over."
Jackie pulled the cruiser to the side of the road. There was a pause with static crackling in it. Then Randolph came on. He didn't bother with any overs. Never had.
"Did you check the church, Unit 2?
"Holy Redeemer?" Linda asked. "Over."
"That's the only one I know out there, Officer Everett, unless a Hindu mosque grew overnight."
Linda didn't think Hindus were the ones who worshipped in mosques, but this didn't seem like the right time for corrections. Randolph sounded tired and grouchy.
"Holy Redeemer wasn't in our sector," she said. "That one belonged to a couple of the new cops, Thibodeau and Searles, I think. Over."
"Check it again," Randolph said, sounding more irritable than ever. "No one's seen Coggins, and a couple of his parishioners want to canoodle with him, or whatever they call it."
Jackie put a finger to her temple and mimed shooting herself. Linda, who wanted to get back and check on her kids at Marta Edmonds' house, nodded.
"Roger that, Chief," Linda said. "We'll do. Over."
"Check the parsonage, too."
There was a pause.
"Also the radio station. The damn thing keeps bellowing away, so there must be someone there."
"Will do."
She started to say over and out, then thought of something else.
"Chief, is there anything new on the TV? Has the president said anything? Over."
"I don't have time to listen to every word that guy drops out of his silly mouth. Just go on and hunt up the Padre and tell him to get his butt back here, and get your butts back too. Out."
Linda racked the mic and looked at Jackie.
"Get our butts back there?" Jackie said. "Our butts?"
"He's a butt," Linda said.
The remark was supposed to be funny, but it fell flat. For a moment, they just sat in the idling car, not talking. Then Jackie spoke in a voice that was almost too low to be heard.
"This is so bad." "Randolph instead of Perkins, you mean?" "That, and the new cops."
She gave the last word verbal quotation marks.
"Those kids. You know what? When I was punching in, Henry Morrison told me Randolph hired 2 more this morning. They came in off the street with Carter Thibodeau, and Pete just signed them up. No questions asked."
Linda knew the sort of guys who hung out with Carter, either at Dippers or at the gas and grocery, where they used the garage to tune up their finance company motorcycles.
2 more? Why?
"Pete told Henry we might need him if that missile doesn't work. To make sure the situation doesn't get out of hand," he said. "And you know who put that idea in his head?" Linda knew, all right.
"At least they're not carrying guns." A couple are. Not department issue, they're personals. By tomorrow, if this doesn't end today, that is, they all will be. And as of this morning, Pete's letting them ride together instead of pairing them with real cops. Some training period, huh? 24 hours, give or take. Do you realize those kids now outnumber us? Linda considered this silently. Hitler youth, Jackie said. That's what I keep thinking. Probably overreacting, but I hope to God this thing ends today, and I don't have to find out. I can't quite see Peter Randolph as Hitler. Me either. I see him more as Hermann Göring. It's Rennie I think of when I think of Hitler. She put the cruiser in gear, made a K-turn, and headed them back toward Christ, the Holy Redeemer Church. 5. The church was unlocked and empty, the generator off. The parsonage was silent, but Reverend Coggins' Chevrolet was parked in the little garage. Peering in, Linda could read two stickers on the bumper. The one on the right, "If the rapture's today, somebody grab my steering wheel." The one on the left boasted, "My other car is a 10-speed. Linda called the second one to Jackie's attention. "He does have a bike. I've seen him riding it, but I don't see it in the garage, so maybe he rode it into town. Saving gas?" "Maybe," Jackie said, "and maybe we ought to check the house to make sure he didn't slip in the shower and break his neck." "Does that mean we might have to look at him naked?" "No one said police work was pretty," Jackie said. "Come on." The house was locked, but in towns where seasonal residents form a large part of the population, the police are adept at gaining entry. They checked the usual places for a spare key. Jackie was the one who found it, hanging on a hook behind a kitchen shutter. It opened the back door. "Reverend Coggins?" Linda called, sticking her head in. "It's the police, Reverend Coggins. Are you here?" No answer. They went in. The lower floor was neat and orderly, but it gave Linda an uncomfortable feeling. She told herself it was just being in someone else's house. A religious person's house, and uninvited. Jackie went upstairs. "Reverend Coggins, police. If you're here, please make yourself known." Linda stood at the foot of the stairs, looking up. The house felt wrong, somehow. That made her think of Janelle, shaking in the grip of her seizure. That had been wrong, too. A queer certainty stole into her mind. If Janelle were here right now, she would have another seizure. Yes, and start talking about queer things. Halloween. And the Great Pumpkin, maybe. It was a perfectly ordinary flight of stairs. But she didn't want to go up there. Just wanted Jackie to report the place was empty so they could go on to the radio station. But when her partner called for her to come up, Linda did. 6. Jackie was standing in the middle of Coggins' bedroom. There was a plain wooden cross on one wall and a plaque on another. The plaque read, "His eye is on the sparrow." The coverlet of the bed was turned back. There were traces of blood on the sheet beneath. "And this," Jackie said, "come around here." Reluctantly, Linda did. Lying on the polished wood floor between the bed and the wall was a knotted length of rope. The knots were bloody. "Looks like somebody beat him," Jackie said grimly. "Hard enough to knock him out, maybe, then they laid him on the..." She looked at the other woman. "No? I take it you didn't grow up in a religious home," Linda said. "I did so. We worshiped the Holy Trinity, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy. What about you?" "Plain old Tapwater Baptist, but I heard about things like this. I think he was flagellating himself." "Yug! People do that for sins, right?" "Yes, and I don't think it ever went entirely out of style." "Then this makes sense. Sort of. Go in the bathroom and look on the toilet tank." Linda made no move to do so. The knotted rope was bad enough. The feel of the house, too empty, somehow, was worse. "Go on. It's nothing that'll bite you, and I'll bet you a dollar to a dime that you've seen worse." Linda went into the bathroom. Two magazines were lying on top of the toilet tank. One was a devotional, The Upper Room. The other was called Young Oriental Slits. Linda doubted if that one was sold in many religious bookshops.
So, Jackie said, are we getting a picture here? He sits on the john, tosses the truffle.
Tosses the truffle? Linda giggled in spite of her nerves, or because of them.
It's what my mother used to call it, Jackie said. Anyway, after he's done with that, he opens a medium-sized can of whoop-ass to expiate his sins, then goes to bed and has happy Asian dreams. This morning he gets up, refreshed and sin-free, does his morning devotionals, then rides into town on his bike. Makes sense?
It did. It just didn't explain why the house felt so wrong to her.
Let's check the radio station, she said. Then we'll head into town ourselves and get coffee. I'm buying.
Good, Jackie said. I want mine black, preferably in a hypo.
7. The low-slung, mostly glass WCIK studio was also locked. But speakers mounted beneath the eaves were playing Good Night, Sweet Jesus, as interpreted by that noted soul singer Perry Como. Behind the studio, the broadcast tower loomed, the flashing red lights at the top barely visible in the strong morning light. Near the tower was a long barn-like structure, which Linda assumed must hold the station's generator and whatever other supplies it needed to keep beaming the miracle of God's love to western Maine, eastern New Hampshire, and possibly the inner planets of the solar system. Jackie knocked, then hammered.
I don't think anybody's here, Linda said.
But this place seemed wrong, too. And the air had a funny smell, stale and sallow. It reminded her of the way her mother's kitchen smelled, even after a good airing, because her mother smoked like a chimney and believed the only things worth eating were those fried in a hot skillet greased with plenty of lard.
Jackie shook her head. We heard someone, didn't we?
Linda had no answer for that because it was true. They had been listening to the station on their drive from the parsonage and had heard a smooth DJ announcing the next record as Another Message of God's Love in Song. This time, the hunt for the key was longer, but Jackie finally found it in an envelope taped beneath the mailbox. With it was a scrap of paper on which someone had scrawled 1693. The key was a dupe and a little sticky, but after some chivying, it worked. As soon as they were in, they heard the steady beep of the security system. The keypad was on the wall. When Jackie punched in the numbers, the beeping quit. Now there was only the music. Perry Como had given way to something instrumental. Linda thought it sounded suspiciously like the organ solo from In a Gata da Vida. The speakers in here were 1,000 times better than the ones outside, and the music was louder, almost like a living thing. Did people work in this holier-than-thou racket? Linda wondered. Answer the phones? Do business? How could they? There was something wrong in here, too. Linda was sure of it. The place felt more than creepy to her. It felt outright dangerous. When she saw that Jackie had unsnapped the strap on her service automatic, Linda did the same. The feel of the gun butt under her hand was good. Thy rod and thy gun butt, they comfort me, she thought.
Hello, Jackie called.
Reverend Coggins?
Anybody?
There was no answer. The reception desk was empty. To the left of it were 2 closed doors. Straight ahead was a window running the entire length of the main room. Linda could see blinking lights inside it. The broadcast studio, she assumed. Jackie pushed the closed doors open with her foot, standing well back. Behind one was an office. Behind the other was a conference room of surprising luxury, dominated by a giant flat-screen TV. It was on, but muted. Anderson Cooper, almost life-sized, looked like he was doing his stand-up on Castle Rock's Main Street. The buildings were draped with flags and yellow ribbons. Linda saw a sign on the hardware store that read, Set Them Free. That made Linda feel even eerier. The super running across the bottom of the screen read, Defense Department sources claim missile strike is imminent.
Why is the TV on? Jackie asked.
Because whoever was minding the store left it that way when
a booming voice interrupted her.
That was Raymond Howell's version of Christ, my Lord and Leader.
Both women jumped.
And this is Norman Drake, reminding you of three important facts. You're listening to the Revival Time Hour on WCIK. God loves you, and he sent his son to die for you on Calvary's cross. It's 9:25 a.m., and as always, we like to remind you, time is short. Have you given your heart to the Lord? Back after this. Norman Drake gave way to a silver-tongued devil selling the entire Bible on DVDs, and the best thing about it was you could pay in monthly installments and return the whole deal if you weren't just as happy as a pig in shit. Linda and Jackie went to the broadcast studio window and looked in. Neither Norman Drake nor the silver-tongued devil was there. But when the commercial ended and the DJ came back to announce the next song of praise, a green light turned red, then a red light turned green. When the music started up, another red light went green. It's automated, Jackie said, the whole freaking thing. Then why do we feel like someone's here? And don't say you don't. Jackie didn't. Because it's weird. The jock even does time checks. Honey, this setup must have cost a fortune. Talk about the ghost in the machine. How long do you think it will run? Probably till the propane runs out and the generator stops. Linda spotted another closed door and opened it with her foot, as Jackie had. Only unlike Jackie, she drew her gun and held it, safety on and muzzle down, beside her leg. It was a bathroom, and it was empty. There was, however, a picture of a very Caucasian Jesus on the wall. I'm not religious, Jackie said, so you'll have to explain to me why people would want Jesus watching them poop. Linda shook her head. Let's get out of here before I lose it, she said. This place is the Radioland version of the Mary Celeste. Jackie looked around uneasily. Well, the vibe is spooky, I'll give you that. She suddenly raised her voice in a harsh shout that made Linda jump. She wanted to tell Jackie not to yell like that, because someone might hear her and come. Or something. Hey! Yo! Anybody here? Last chance! Nothing. No one. Outside, Linda took a deep breath. Once when I was a teenager, some friends and I went to Bar Harbor, and we stopped for a picnic at this scenic turnout. There were half a dozen of us. The day was clear, and you could see practically all the way to Ireland. When we were done eating, I said I wanted to take a picture. My friends were all horsing around and grab-assing, and I kept backing up, trying to get everyone in the frame. Then this one girl, Arabella, my best friend back then, stopped trying to give this other girl a wedgie and shouted, "Stop, Linda, stop." I stopped and looked around. Know what I saw? Jackie shook her head. The Atlantic Ocean. I'd backed up all the way to the drop-off at the edge of the picnic area. There was a warning sign, but no fence or guardrail. One more step and I would have gone down. And how I felt then is how I felt in there. Lynn, it was empty. I don't think so, and I don't think you do either. It was spooky, sure, but we checked the rooms. Not the studio. Plus the TV was on and the music was too loud. You don't think they'd turn it up that loud ordinarily, do you? How do I know what holy rollers do? Jackie asked. Maybe they were expecting the apocalypse. Lips. Whatever. Do you want to check the storage barn? Absolutely not, Linda said, and that made Jackie snort laughter. Okay, our report is no sign of the Rev, correct? Correct. Then we're off to town, and coffee. Before getting into Unit 2's shotgun seat, Linda took one more look at the studio building, sitting there wreathed in white bread audio joy. There was no other sound. She realized she didn't hear a single bird singing, and wondered if they had all killed themselves smashing into the dome. Surely that wasn't possible. Was it? Jackie pointed at the mic. Want me to give the place a shout through the loudspeaker? Say if anyone's hiding in there, they should beat feet into town? Because I just thought of this. Maybe they were scared of us. What I want is for you to stop screwing around and get out of here. Jackie didn't argue. She reversed down the short driveway to Little Bitch Road and turned the cruiser toward the mill. 8. Time passed. Religious music played. Norman Drake returned and announced that it was 9:34, Eastern Daylight God Loves You time. This was followed by an ad for Jim Rennie's used cars.
delivered by the second selectman himself.
"It's our annual fall sale spectacular, and boy, did we overstock," Big Jim said in a rueful, "the joke's on me" voice. "We've got Fords, Chevys, Plymouths. We've got the hard-to-get Dodge Ram and even the harder-to-get Mustang. Folks, I'm sitting on not one or two, but three Mustangs that are like new. One, the famous V6 convertible, and each comes with the famous Jim Rennie Christian guarantee. We service what we sell, we finance, and we do it all at low, low prices. And right now," he chuckled more ruefully than ever, "we've just got to clear this lot. So come on down. The coffee pot's always on, neighbor, and you'll love the feeling when Big Jim's dealing."
A door neither woman had noticed eased open at the back of the studio. Inside were more blinking lights, a galaxy of them. The room was little more than a cubby choked with wires, splitters, routers, and electronic boxes. You would have said there was no room for a man. But the chef was beyond skinny. He was emaciated. His eyes were only glitters sunk deep in his skull. His skin was pale and blotchy. His lips folded loosely inward over gums that had lost most of their teeth. His shirt and pants were filthy, and his hips were naked wings. Chef's underwear days were now just a memory. It is doubtful that Sammy Bushy would have recognized her missing husband. He had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in one hand. He could only eat soft things now, and a Glock 9 in the other. He went to the window overlooking the parking lot, thinking he'd rush out and kill the intruders if they were still there. He had almost done it while they were inside. Only he'd been afraid, because demons couldn't actually be killed. When their human bodies died, they just flew into another host. When they were between bodies, the demons looked like blackbirds. Chef had seen this in vivid dreams that came on the increasingly rare occasions when he slept. They were gone, however. His Atman had been too strong for them. Rennie had told him he had to shut down out back, and Chef Bushy had. But he might have to start up some of the cookers again because there had been a big shipment to Boston a week ago, and he was almost out of product. He needed smoke. It was what his Atman fed on these days. But for now he had enough. He had given up on the blues music that had been so important to him in his Phil Bushy stage of life. B.B. King, Coco and Hound Dog Taylor, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf, even the immortal little Walter. He had given up on fucking. He had even pretty much given up on moving his bowels, had been constipated since July, but that was okay. What humiliated the body fed the Atman. He checked the parking lot and the road beyond once more to make sure the demons weren't lurking. Then tucked the automatic into his belt at the small of his back and headed for the storage shed, which was actually more of a factory these days. A factory that was shut down. But he could and would fix that if necessary. Chef went to get his pipe. 9. Rusty Everett stood looking into the storage shed behind the hospital. He was using a flashlight because he and Ginny Tomlinson, now the administrative head of medical services in Chester's Mill, crazy as that was, had decided to kill the power to every part of the plant that didn't absolutely need it. From his left, in its own shed, he could hear the big generator roaring away, eating ever deeper into the current long tank of propane. "Most of the tanks are gone," Twitch had said. And by God, they were. According to the card on the door, there's supposed to be 7, but there's only 2. On that, Twitch was wrong. There was only 1. Rusty ran the beam of his flashlight over the blue CRHOSP, stenciled on the tank's silver side below the supply company's Dead River logo.
"Told you," Twitch said from behind him, making Rusty jump.
"You told me wrong, there's only 1.
Bullshit!
Twitch stepped into the doorway, looked while Rusty shone the beam around, highlighting boxes of supplies surrounding a large and largely empty center area, said,
"It's not bullshit."
"No."
"Fearless leader, someone is stealing our propane."
Rusty didn't want to believe this, but saw no way around it. Twitch squatted down.
"Look here."
Rusty dropped to one knee. The quarter acre behind the hospital had been asphalted the previous summer, and without any cold weather to crack or buckle it, not yet anyway, the area was a smooth black sheet. It made it easy to see the tire tracks in front of the shed's sliding doors.
That looks like it could have been a town truck, Twitch remarked.
Or any other big truck.
Nevertheless, you might want to check the storage shed behind the town hall. Twitch no trustum Big Chief Rennie. Him bad medicine.
Why would he take our propane? The selectmen have plenty of their own.
They walked to the door leading into the hospital's laundry, also shut down, at least for the time being. There was a bench beside the door. A sign posted on the bricks read, "Smoking here will be banned as of January 1st. Quit now and avoid the rush." Twitch took out his Marlboros and offered them to Rusty. Rusty waved them away, then reconsidered and took one. Twitch lit them up.
"How do you know?"
he asked.
"How do I know what?"
"That they've got plenty of their own. Have you checked?"
"No," Rusty said, "but if they were going to poach, why from us? Not only is stealing from the local hospital usually considered bad form by the better class of people, the post office is practically right next door. They must have some."
"Maybe Rennie and his friends already snatched the post office's gas. How much would they have, anyway? One tank, two peanuts."
"I don't understand why they'd need any. It makes no sense."
"Nothing about any of this makes sense,"
Twitch said, and yawned so hugely that Rusty could hear his jaws creak. "You finished rounds, I take it?" Rusty had a moment to consider the surreal quality of that question. Since Haskell's death, Rusty had become the hospital's head doc, and Twitch, a nurse just 3 days ago, was now what Rusty had been, a physician's assistant.
"Yep," Twitch sighed. "Mr. Carty isn't going to live out the day."
Rusty had thought the same thing about Ed Carty, who was suffering from end-stage stomach cancer a week ago, and the man was still hanging in.
"Comatose?" "Roger that, Sensei."
Twitch was able to count their other patients off on the digits of one hand, which Rusty knew was extraordinarily lucky. He thought he might even have felt lucky, if he hadn't been so tired and worried.
"George Werner, I'd call stable."
Werner, an Eastchester resident, 60 years old and obese, had suffered a myocardial infarction on Dome Day. Rusty thought he would pull through. This time.
"As for Emily Whitehouse," Twitch shrugged, "it ain't good, Sensei."
Emmy Whitehouse, 40 years old and not even an ounce overweight, had suffered her own MI an hour or so after Rory Dinsmore's accident. It had been much worse than George Werner's, because she'd been an exercise freak, and had suffered what Doc Haskell had called a health club blowout.
"The Freeman girl is getting better, Jimmy Saroy is holding up, and Nora Coveland is totally cool. Out after lunch. On the whole, not so bad."
"No," Rusty said, "but it'll get worse, I guarantee you. And if you suffered a catastrophic head injury, would you want me to operate on you?"
"Not really," Twitch said. "I keep hoping Gregory House will show up."
Rusty butted his cigarette in the can and looked at the nearly empty supply shed. Maybe he should have a peek into the storage facility behind the town hall. What could it hurt? This time he was the one who yawned.
"How long can you keep this up?" Twitch asked.
All the banter had gone out of his voice.
"I only ask because right now, you're what this town's got."
"As long as I have to. What worries me is getting so tired I screw something up. And effacing stuff that's way beyond my skill set." He thought of Rory Dinsmore and Jimmy Saroy. Thinking of Jimmy was worse because Rory was now beyond the possibility of medical mistakes. Jimmy, on the other hand. Rusty saw himself back in the operating room listening to the soft bleep of the equipment, saw himself looking down at Jimmy's pale, bare leg with a black line drawn on it where the cut would have to be made. Thought of Dougie Twitchell trying out his anesthesiologist skills. Felt Ginny Tomlinson slapping a scalpel into his gloved hand, and then looking at him over the top of her mask with her cool blue eyes. "God, spare me from that," he thought. Twitch put a hand on Rusty's arm.
"Take it easy," he said. "One day at a time."
"Fuck that, 1 hour at a time," Rusty said, and got up. "I have to go over to the health center, see what's shaking there. Thank Christ this didn't happen in the summer. We would have had 3,000 tourists and 700 summer camp kids on our hands."
"Want me to come?"
Rusty shook his head. Check on Ed Carty again, why don't you? See if he's still in the land of the living. Rusty took one more look at the supply shed, then plotted around the corner of the building and on a diagonal toward the health center on the far